Shalom and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Judea to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. And I want to bless you wherever you are, because I know this is a tough time, not an easy time, and minimally a different time, and for some people really a hard time. I just want to send you God's blessings from Judea, from the land of Israel, and give you personal love right now. So wherever you are, feel it. Feel a little bit of the embrace of the God of Israel and of Judea. And we have a great show lined up for you here for your edification and entertainment. We have a great show lined up. First, we have Malka Fleischer, who's going to be joining us and talking about what coronavirus life is doing to Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day. Then I'll talk a little bit about one of my favorite topics, which is the recognition of the international recognition of Jewish rights in the land of Israel at San Remo, which was exactly 100 years ago. And that will lead me right into Colonel Richard Kemp, who was with me on Zoom. He's a British warrior who was in the British Army for 30 years. And amongst other things that he does today is that he defends Israel and Israel's rights, and also remembers the good part of the British heritage in the land of Israel. So we'll be talking with Colonel Richard Kemp. From there, we'll go, of course, to our beloved Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike is going to be joining us on the spiritual meaning of this 100 years of recognition, and also on biblical skin lesions. That's right, a little bit of Tazria Metzora. So we have a great show lined up for you here on the Land of Israel Network, on the Yishai Fleisher Show. It's great to have you. If you love the show, give us a good rating on whatever podcast system you listen to. That would be great. Check out YishaiFleisher.com, all the other stuff. I have articles coming out. I have more videos coming out this week, including in this email that I'm sending out. This week is my Zoom tour of Hebron. So you can come to Hebron. And you could also come to Hebron when this whole thing clears through Hebron Fund, hebronfund.org. Come visit us, and if you can't visit us, then support us, be part of it, be part of the story. And, of course, all the stuff that I'm doing is happening at YishaiFleisher.com. It's easy, and it's just a way to connect, and especially during this time where we're looking for connectivity, for content, and for learning, we hope to be providing you just a little bit of that. I know I'm getting it from a lot of other people, and I'm really trying to gain a lot at this time. In any case, we are in the mode of Yom HaAtzmaut, Yom HaZikaron, which is Israel Memorial Day, then Israel Independence Day, and Jerusalem Day, and then finally leading all the way up to, well, before that also Lag BaOmer, which is the celebration of the mystical Torah, and then leading all the way up to Shavuot, that incredible holiday of receiving the Torah. So we're in a very important swing right now. And I hope the show is going to be part of that celebration, including one more holiday, which is 100 years since international recognition of Jewish rights in the land of Israel at San Remo. That's on today's show. So here we go. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting from my little room. That's right. My little room is where we're all at. But I have a little workroom here in our apartment in Gush Etzion, south of Jerusalem, on the way to Hebron, between Hebron and Jerusalem. And I am joined by my beloved Malka Fleischer. Malka,
here I am,
welcome.
All the way from the other side of the house.
Yes. Did you see that meme where they had like the different like airport codes for living room, kitchen? Like kitchen was,
oh, that's funny.
You know, CTH, you know, living room was like...
I didn't see that one. I didn't see that one.
LVG, you know?
That's funny. I didn't see that, but I did see... The before Passover, there was a meme about like different trips that you can take during Pesach this year, and it was like the laundry pile hike, like climb the laundry pile.
Yeah, that's right. And there's been a lot of
like splash in the bath, that kind of thing.
There's been a lot of jokes about that, and there's been like you see the guy who is, there's a lot of people who pour oil and a little bit of water on the floor, and then that's their new treadmill.
That was funny when that came out, yeah.
There's a few of those.
Although I have to say, like, none of it is as funny. Like, I feel like it was funnier at the beginning. Now it's, like, not as funny.
Yeah, yeah. And there's definitely a lot of psychology that's happening right now for different people. For example, I see the kids starting to more kind of become Zoom learners. I saw yesterday Elazar, our son, doing flute lessons on Zoom.
Yeah.
Leah does piano lessons on Zoom. And it is all very, very interesting. But we really, before we get to the cuteness of it or the novelness of it,
novelty.
Right? The novelty. Thank you. Thank you for teaching me. And and there is a lot of novel things to this novel coronavirus.
Right.
But what's not novel at all is human suffering.
Right.
And there's a lot of people who are suffering. And it's so important to keep people in your hearts and in your minds praying for other people.
Right.
I was very proud of you, Malka, this week because you had a chance to do some chesed, some kindness, and you went shopping for a couple, I wouldn't call them elderly, but an older couple who could use some help.
Right. It was a very small thing. I just went to
You know what? It was a small thing, but I felt happy for you and even like a kind of happy jealousy, which I was like,
you want to do something nice for somebody.
Somebody, you did a kindness. I'm doing niceness.
Well, you're
niceness.
Keeping people educated and entertained.
Entertained. That's right. No, I
that's important.
I do think that. I definitely think that. I want to think that people need companionship and brain stimulation,
right.
And also
jokes.
And also a real sense of passion, mm-hmm. and history. Right now, I am very very passionate. I'm in this like throw. Of passion. You know, everybody's got like these side interests. I have a side interest that has been interesting to me for a long time, which is like San Remo Accords that led to the Balfour Declaration,
right.
That led to the San Remo Accords, that led to the mandate and the beginnings of the State of Israel. It's been something that I've been kind of reading about for a long time and have formulated a lot of thoughts about. And I'm like suddenly like hyper involved in it because this week is 100 years.
Wow.
100 years. Since the Allied powers who defeated the Axis, the powers including the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and on April 25th, 1920, in San Remo, Italy, they gathered, most of them, the main high contracting parties were England, France, Russia and Japan, strangely, and they got together to talk about what to do with the Middle East after the Ottoman Empire was dissolved.
Right. What year was that, Yishai?
1920.
Right.
Well, it was dissolved.
100 years.
That's right. 100 years today, and then 2 years subsequent, they finally finalized what they decided in 1920, which was. That there would be this new system, a very interesting, novel system called the mandatory or mandates.
Right.
And basically, this was really interesting. Big old countries were supposed to tutor new little countries into independence.
That's cute.
Yeah, well...
I mean, it's sort of counterintuitive because
right.
You have these, like, empire-y type countries. You have... England,
right.
Which had its empire,
right.
And Russia, which wasn't an empire,
right.
And who else did you say? Japan. They weren't exactly occupiers. Well, Japan was on the other side,
right.
So not Japan.
They wanted to very badly.
Who did you say was part of
Russia?
Russia, England, and who else did
this
you
was,
say?
This was already a,
was on
this
the
was
Allied
Russia.
Side who created the mandatory
France,
system.
England,
France,
Russia,
France,
Japan?
Definitely an empire.
Yeah. Yep, you're right.
So, and then I guess they like moved away from all that.
They were shifting gears.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tremendous shift of gears.
It was sort of like a benevolent big brotherhood where they felt that they would like reach down to these like little indigenous type peoples and like show them how to be civilized and run themselves.
Partially, yes, but they partially also believed that it would bring to world stability, which in many ways I think they were right. They were on the heels of the horrors of World War One, and they
right.
wanted a new system for the world. No more secret agreements. No more these big giant behemoths controlling. Let local people control their stuff. You know.
Mm.
By the way, there's an interesting parallel to that, and that is states versus a federal government.
Mm.
Right. States power versus federal government power. A big empire or little
right.
space, and really that's tension. It's a tension that continues to exist in the United States. An important tension. Maybe the very tension itself is an important thing. Any case, listen, we're not getting into the political philosophy of it all. The bottom line is that It was recognized then that the Jewish people should have a right to have a right, have a historical right, not should have, but have a historical
right.
And
that it should be recognized.
And that it should be recognized and that it should be reconstituted. Reconstituted.
From way back when.
From way back. But that way back never was forgotten.
Disappeared from the
consciousness. Especially for people, and here's the key, especially for people who know and care and feel connected to the Bible. The Bible is a key part of the story.
Right.
It's a key part of the story. It's not the only part of the story, though. It's interesting. You know, I love talking with you about this because just talking about it out loud makes it kind of clear to me. There were people like T.E. Lawrence, famous Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes.
He saw it not in a biblical way. He saw that it was in England's interest to get rid of the Ottoman Empire and to take over their land.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they were going to do it is by empowering regional actors under this idea of self-determination.
Who were allies.
Right. And so the Arabs would turn against...
Mercenaries, if you will.
No, not mercenaries.
Well, not mercenaries because they give up total control.
Allies is the right word.
To those peoples
is the right word. They would be allies. They would be pro-British allies. And he wanted to turn the Arabs into pro-British allies that would fight against the Turks. And the Jews as well, who he saw not very differently than the Arabs. Saw them as regional players.
Right.
Who would be favorable. So he didn't have a biblical outlook. It was a geopolitical outlook.
Right.
Fine.
Okay.
And then there were people like... Balfour, Arthur James Balfour, and also David Lloyd George. It's easier to remember. The British, easier to forget. They have a lot of these like names, or T.E. Lawrence. Another guy that I found that was a very important person that kind of is forgotten by history is Charles Prestwich Scott, who was the editor of the Manchester Guardian, which later became The Guardian.
Oh, wow.
And he was hyper pro-Zionism.
Wow. Did you find any of his old articles?
You know, Malka, it's interesting. You know, there's a Jewish saying.
Yeah.
Rabbinic saying. B'derech she'adam rotzeh lechet molichin oto.
Okay.
A path the person wants to take, they take him.
No.
So I was in a bookstore. And the truth is, I don't really go into bookstores so much today.
Especially these days.
Right. And just in general, I'm like, okay.
And there's so much to read and right. so much online and so much to do and be with the kids. And
the house
stuff.
Is full of books and it's
right.
like, die.
You can't, like,
don't
buy
anymore.
Another book. Yeah.
But I went into a bookstore to find a certain book and I didn't find it. And out of nowhere, a wink. Wink. You see my winking? I'm winking at you. Slink. Winked at me this book by a guy who I semi-know. Which his name is Elliot Jaeger, which is spelled Jagger, but it's Jaeger, like Jaegermeister.
Yeah, cool.
And the book is called The Balfour Declaration.
Okay.
And it's all about the actors and players, including, by the way, a whole chapter on the women who played a big role in the birth of the Balfour Declaration. And I was like, all right, I'm going to buy it. So I bought it.
Wow.
And what a world I swam into. You know, what a world. What a world of people and rabbis and Herzls and Jabotinskys and Weizmanns and all these amazing, amazing people that like fought tooth and nail. And really, really, and people that I didn't really know much about. Nachum Sokolow and others. So I was just like, wow. And the Rothschilds, various right. Rothschilds. And the people who were against, by the way, some Jews, some of the biggest opponents to Zionism were Jews.
Well, Manishtana.
And I can even understand where they were coming from. You know where they were coming from?
No.
They thought that their local achievements of like becoming a great British citizen, a French citizen.
It would like make them the Jew again, and they right. didn't want to be the Jew again.
By the way, it happened in the Arab countries. In the Arab countries, the minute Israel was announced.
Right, they were
the
like,
Arabs
get out of here. You're not us anymore.
I have spoken to many an old Jew who lived in Arab countries, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Iraq. I've spoken to them, and they all told me the same thing, Malka. I'm telling you, I spoke to them myself. They said to me, the Arabs told us, Ruhul Quds.
Go to Jerusalem.
Go to Jerusalem.
Get out of here.
Yeah, you got
by
your
By the way,
place.
Leave us all your stuff.
Right.
And your house.
Yeah,
and
but,
your business.
And get out.
And your jewelry.
Ruhul Quds. Go to Jerusalem. That's what they told them. When the guy in Afghanistan told me that, I could believe it. Like, everywhere.
Afghanistan, Bechal.
Yeah, Afghanistan used to be a really nice
wow.
place. So the bottom line is that.
And they did.
They did.
They went
definitely
Jerusalem.
Did. And they were encouraged to do
yes,
so.
Yes, in very, very emphatic terms.
So anyway, Maka, all this stuff has really risen up in my heart about, you know, something that happened 100 years ago. And I've been involved in the last few days in all kinds of broadcasts dealing with that.
Hmm.
Including my own broadcast that I'm putting together.
Of course, you're not really, like, so far I haven't seen anything. Aside from speaking to you.
Right.
Not that I'm Mrs. Read Every Newspaper.
Right.
But aside from speaking to you, I haven't seen anything about San Remo. And in general, I don't think so many people know about the San Remo Accords. Most of the time when people talk about the foundation of the State of Israel, they go back to the UN partition plan.
That's right. They do go back to the UN partition plan. That's right. And that is a big mistake, because the UN partition plan was valuable in that 33 countries at the UN, you know, recognize that there should be a Jewish state anywhere in the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thrust of that was to shrink what was already promised to the Jewish people, a second shrinking. One shrinking already happened in 1922 when the British lopped off 77% of the land of Israel and gave it to their Hashemite friends and created a Transjordan later to become Jordan. And then this UNSCOP UN partition, this UN expeditionary kind of commission about Palestine basically came up with this idea of partitioning the land of Israel. And the Jews were really against it. Everybody was against it. But they agreed because they said, okay, you know what I mean? Let's take what we can get type of thing.
Right. It's you needed something. You needed to, we had just all been killed by the Nazis and they needed some place to be.
Right. That's right. It was bitter. And they close their nose and they
as
did
you,
it.
As you so often state, Yishai, you know, when Israel finally did declare independence.
Go ahead.
Jews, like basically who had just gotten off the boat from Europe and had just been fattened up enough to like be alive on a trip from Europe to Israel, were given, like, as your uncle always talks about, that when he landed in Israel, he was given challah and milk, right?
And milk, that's right.
And then he was, as I understand, like most of the Jews were then sent off to war. Any able-bodied men were sent off to go fight. And the chances were bad that the Jews were going to win that war.
Right. Very bad. Very bad.
And here you had these people who just came out of the ashes and they were about to go right back to the ashes.
And many did.
Right.
We lost 1% of the population.
Wow, wow, wow.
6,000 men died. 6,000 people died.
Wow.
In that war. That was Israel's most tragic war. And there was like 600,000 people in the country.
Right, it was like...
like everybody knew somebody that died.
It was like not even Jerusalem. It was like not even the population of Jerusalem today.
Yeah. Jerusalem today is 1 million people. So, gosh. So...
you shy?
Yeah, no.
Hold it together.
No, I'm holding it together. So you're absolutely right. The partition plan, I'm glad you brought that up because you reminded me of a good point that I'm added into the article just now, took a note. But like, partition plan did not give birth to Israel. It was the catalyst for announcing Israel's independence. Yes, so it has a place in history.
Right. It started the wheels turning, basically.
Well, it started, but at that moment,
the machine was assembled, and
right,
someone had to turn the key on.
Yes, absolutely. So that was 47. The 1947 partition plan was also a General Assembly resolution. So no teeth in the General Assembly by law. Resolution was just, it was just an idea. It wasn't even a real thing. And it was rejected by the Arabs. So these three things.
Rejected strongly.
Rejected strongly. These things. But they actually rejected it both verbally and
physically.
Physically attacking Israel. So it was a non-starter. The whole thing is a fraud. The UN resolution.
What about San Remo? How did the Arabs react to that?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is that there were different Arabs at the time also. Some.
I guess they were in the business. They were in the midst of getting their own care packages.
That's exactly it.
They were like, they were all standing to benefit at that time,
right,
from all these good
deals. And the vision was very equitable. When Israel was going to be born, so were three new Arab states. Iraq at the time was called Mesopotamia.
Right.
Syria in Lebanon, and later also part of Israel was going to become Jordan. So four Arab countries were born at the same time that Israel was born. So the idea was
everyone was feeling very, like...
Right, and there was even some camaraderie.
They were on the receiving end.
Right, there was camaraderie at the time as well. And the sense, you know, now let's be truthful, soon after started horrific Arab riots.
Right.
The 1920,
yeah, in the 1920s there were, 1920, so that's
21, and then 1929, and it became bad. And right. Sadly...
So that does not seem to lend itself to the notion that Arabs were okay with the idea of Israel creating a state here.
No, they were not okay with it. Okay, they were not okay with it, as I've written many times. It's against their religion. That's the bottom line. It's against the religion. And if you don't understand that, you don't understand the situation. It's against their religion to have a powerful Jewish state in the midst of their land that they think that they've controlled in the past. So that's they definitely were not happy about that. But it doesn't matter, because the Arabs are not the whole story here.
Right.
The Arabs buy in or not buy in is not everything. It's just not everything.
Okay.
The real story was the full international recognition of Jewish rights in the land of Israel by the international community. And that happened there, just like as we said before, both recognition of our historical connection and reconstitution. These were important things, and I wish to God that that a lot more of these ideas would be prevalent today. By the way, in the original mandate was an idea of that there would be Jewish land purchase, and that the England had to help create close settlement, quote unquote, of Jews in the land of Israel, and that there would be also a law of return that Jews from all over the world would have the right to come to this place, et cetera, et cetera.
And one thing that like is unbelievably up for debate today, I still can't believe that it's up for a debate, but it is up for debate today, which is that Israel would be Jewish.
Israel was going to be Jewish.
Jewish.
You exactly led to my next point. But what about the Gentiles living in the country? What about the Arabs?
They would be treated well and be provided for civilly.
Civil and religious rights were to be guaranteed, but not political or political or national rights. Meaning to say, you could be a resident.
It's called, in Israel, we call it Ger Toshav.
Ger Toshav, you'd have all the rights and opportunities, but you want to be a voting member because you've got
Israel's
your country.
Israel's Jewish.
Right, Israel's Jewish.
And that's like written into the law.
Right, not by, we're not, this Jewish state is not Jewish because it's a majority of Jews. In fact, when all this stuff was enunciated, we were a minority. It was understood that this place was going to be by charter, by its very...
We're changing it, yeah.
Right.
Making a change.
It's going to be the Jewish state, this area. And not because you're a majority or a minority or whatever it is. It's not by that. It's not by... And Churchill wrote a letter. He said, it's not by sufferance, but by right. It's your right. It's your land. So you get to take it, okay? And the Arabs living there, God bless them, they have every right for their civil and religious rights.
Right.
But their states are other. And they're here as they
right.
were
it's
never.
It's not like you can have your property necessarily just ripped out of your hands.
Absolutely not. Your property was going to be protected. Any case, Malka, it's been busy days at Hebron. There's a lot of meetings because we're trying to do something for Yom HaZikaron.
Oh, that's nice.
And there's and the state of Israel is actually locking down for Yom HaZikaron.
Although I saw that culture minister Miri Regev really fought for local municipalities to be able to do fireworks displays.
Right.
I hope that Hebron will do a fireworks display.
That's
from
the plan.
Maratama
yes.
Kailah.
And we're trying
and
to
you
film
should,
it.
Like film it and possibly, I don't know if you'll be able to do a live stream or whatever, but I hope that people will at least be able to see and throughout Judea and different cities. Now you're not supposed to congregate and go see it.
Right.
But the idea was that, look, it's very interesting, Yishai. Yom HaZikaron, Israel Memorial Day, and Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day, are very, very high on the national observance scale.
Right.
You definitely have people who don't, right? And there's all kinds of politics, and you have Haredim who don't necessarily celebrate. Although, if you go to the national parks, you will see them like walking through. Oh, they're just conveniently walking through, and they're like looking at everything, and they like secretly really want to be there. So many of them, but they don't like necessarily fully. Put out their Israeli flags or anything.
They may not state it as a overt philosophy, but the majority of ultra-Orthodox Jews today
right. appreciate the state of Israel.
Exactly. It's clear that they, and not only that, and I'm going to say something that they're starting to say, which is they're Israelis.
Right. And if you hear they're Hebrew, their Hebrew is Israeli Hebrew.
They're culturally Israelis.
Right. Although they may speak Yiddish in the house, but when they go out on the street, they're able to make a deal Yiddish, like anybody else.
Yiddish is a small minority of the Israeli Blackadders.
Well,
you know, but I was just in Bnei Brak yesterday,
wearing gloves and a mask.
You bet I was.
And socially distanced.
I had
everyone.
Two masks. I was actually in danger of dying from asphyxiation. But in any case, I was actually in the belly of the Bnei Brak beautiful beast. I had to film yesterday some stuff, and I went to, it was really an amazing experience, Monk. I just to see Bnei Brak, you know, I haven't been there in a while, and a really, really, really very special place, and just a urban kind of jungle of, like, you know, old houses and new people. Houses and people and buses and things. It's just like a real bustling place.
Although I guess it wasn't so bustling.
No, it was 10% bustle.
10%, which is a low percentage.
Maybe less than 10%. Maybe 6%.
Wow. So there were a few people out, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But still lively.
Yeah, they're
still lively.
Yeah, they gotta live.
There's a few shawarma places open, and I didn't go in.
Yeah.
Couldn't do it.
That was smart of you. You know, Yishai, so regarding Yom Ha'atzmaut and Yom HaZikaron, I grew up in the United States, right? And we had Memorial Day. And Memorial Day, now maybe things have changed because I haven't lived in America for for 17 years. I haven't lived in America. But when I grew up, Memorial Day was a little bit a day that there were sales at the mall.
Right.
Right. It was like a little bit a day, like there were memorials. Right. And you could go to events that were held, but it wasn't the focus. It wasn't mainstream. I think that's the real way to say it. It wasn't like a mainstream thing to do to, like, spend part of your day doing memorial to fallen soldiers.
Right.
But in Israel, it is absolutely mainstream. And the fact that David Ben-Gurion stuck Israel's Memorial Day on the absolute hip of Israel Independence Day was a stroke of real genius.
Yeah, genius. Absolute genius.
I have some major, major issues with David Ben-Gurion myself.
Right.
But that was like prophecy.
Absolutely.
That was like, he was so right. So there's so many families in Israel. And it happens to be not just Memorial Day for soldiers, but also for victims of terror. So when you put together the fact that so many people have lost a relative, or even like not a nuclear family relative, but like a cousin or a second cousin or a great grandparent or something like that, to the fact that there are terror victims as well, you have a large swath of the country for whom Memorial Day is a very personal day. And even for people for whom Memorial Day is not a personal day, because pretty much all of us understand the tenuousness. Let's aside from the fact that Hashem watches out for us, right? That Hashem has basically shown us that our situation here is tenuous, that there's enemies, that we could be attacked at any time, that things are dynamic here and not always for the good. Memorial Day, because of this, Memorial Day is something that people take very seriously. You know, freedom isn't free, as they say in America. We recognize this very much. Moreover, we have many people who alive today who were there for independence, right? So it's not a legend for us. It's real life. So it was a very painful decision this year to shut cemeteries.
Yeah.
Now this was a big deal because they felt they had to do it for coronavirus protection. At the same time, you know, the cemeteries are filled on Memorial Day,
right?
Especially the Israeli military cemeteries, but not only. The cemeteries are filled, and people go and they stand by the graves of their loved one, and they clean them, and they cry, and they like say Tehillim there, and the siren goes off across the country, and they stand. And soldiers are dispatched to every bereaved family is dispatched a soldier who stands with them. You wrote an article about when you were one of those dispatched soldiers when you were in your army service as a young man.
Right.
Younger man. You're still a young man.
Younger man.
Younger man. So they shuttered the cemeteries. Now apparently the bereaved families organization like issued a formal support for this because everyone understands the situation. At the same time, it hurts so much that police basically said that they are going to shut the cemeteries, but will not physically bar family members who like push through. Basically, if there's someone who feels so strongly that they have to get to the grave of their loved one, then they're not going to stop them, right. Which I think is a kind of beautiful piece of sensitivity.
And that ties into another law that they had in Israel, which is it's hard for me to even talk about it, but basically they're allowing people, if somebody's dying of coronavirus, they're letting the family member like say goodbye or something like
wow.
that. They had a whole discussion about that. But
Shalom Nida.
Shalom Nida.
You shouldn't know from it.
And there's been a lot of sacrifice around Jewish history. And there's a lot of sacrifice today for health. We honor the health workers around the world who are trying so hard to keep everybody, to keep societies afloat.
Right.
And we honor all the parents who are dealing with their kids. We honor all the husbands and wives who are dealing with one another. And we
I honor you, Yishai, for dealing with me.
I honor you for dealing with me. That's the real truth.
I want to honor also like the school teachers who are trying to educate from afar and have to like learn on one foot. They have to learn all this technology and handle this new kind of teaching. I spoke to the principal of our son's school who says that she works 12 hours a day right now.
Wow.
Dealing with like school related things. So she's working so hard and like no one realizes because no one sees her and like no one hears from her.
Wow.
And I told her that she's doing holy work, that she's really like keeping kids learning, keeping them afloat.
And keeping the parents safe.
Right. And that's humongous today.
There's a lot of beauty to this tricky and challenging time. I got a letter from my Russian friends in America. They said, here, not so good. Oy. We are dealing with this zaraza. Zaraza means infectious disease,
and many
people dying.
He said, we
look to him. That's what he wrote to me. That's my buddy Fred.
Fema. God should bless you wherever you are. Yeah. Only he knows what this is all about.
Right.
I hope that we will all be wise enough and blessed enough to look inside and see if we can find our own personal reasons why this is going on and what we can glean from it and how we can improve ourselves. How can we get closer to where we're supposed to get?
And also, maybe a shameless plug for the state of Israel, which is like maybe this is a time to really dig down and think, what is the rebirth of the Jewish people and land of Israel all about for me?
Right.
How do I connect to it? How do I add to it? How do I be part of this amazing story? This is, in my opinion, and not just my opinion, but it's the call of the generation, the opportunity of a generation. We're really part of something so huge. And as Rabbi Mike said in the last half hour, we're really the dream of 2,000 years is being fulfilled in us. And so we gotta really, what is the word? Play hard or go home. What is it? Go big or go home.
Yeah, go big or go home.
Go big or go home. And this is really,
don't miss
really
your chance.
God bless you, Malka Fleischer. Happy 72nd
yes.
Israel Independence Day, the embodiment of the Jewish people. Happy 100 years since
San Remo. Wait, what is next week? Is there going to be a show next week?
There will be a show, Bezrat Hashem, on Yom Ha'atzmaut, I think.
That's going to be fun.
That's right. All right, folks, more great stuff here on the Land of Israel Network. Malka Fleischer, thank you for joining me. Please leave us at least 7-star ratings, 19-star ratings on iTunes, et cetera, wherever you find this podcast. I just mean to say,
Help us out.
Wink, wink, you know?
And that'll only help this content get farther.
That's right. And also go to YishaiFleischer.com. If you want to donate, buy me a cup of coffee for this week's show. That sounds really great. And check out our sponsors, Hebron Fund, HebronFund.org, bringing the Jewish people back to Hebron in many different ways, including touring you in English when there's regular tours. And also check out this week I did an awesome YouTube zoomed into YouTube video of a tour of Hebron. I'll be sending that out.
Looking forward.
Yeah, that's going to be really
fun. That'll be something nice to do on Yom Ha'atzmaut with your kids if you're out there somewhere.
That's right.
Wherever you are.
Good idea, Malka. And check out Tchelet, True Blue Jews.
We've got to get some new seat for the kids, Yishai Shavuos.
That's right. You're right. Thank you. We've got to order that today. And that's the blue string. That's TEKHELET.com. And also check out Jewish Press, jewishpress.org, who does a great job of getting the show out to the world. God bless you, Malka Fleischer, and continued health, for you and for this family and for all the families of Israel and lovers of Israel around the world.
Looking forward to all of you coming back to Israel. I know there's so many of you
listening. Not just virtually.
No, actually. And, like, I want to hug.
That's right. As we say in Corona life, next year, in person.
Right.
More great stuff is on the way. God bless. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Stay connected. And shalom.
Shalom.
Tune in for a special Holocaust Memorial Day episode of Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston for an interview with Israel's oldest living broadcast journalist, Walter Biggin, who describes his experiences growing up in Germany.
Let me give you an example how we had to entertain ourselves. We might sit in a tram where you had to be in a special place, and some Nazi might sneeze. Gesundheit. So we would, with half Yiddish and half local dialect, say, Gesundheit. And the man would say, thank you very much, you know, in German. And what we actually said was not Gesundheit, health. We used to say, Gesundheit, to death.
For the full show, click on Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, we are celebrating 100 years since the San Remo Accords, which was the first and maybe deepest international recognition of Jewish rights in the land of Israel. And this segment, I am joined by Colonel Richard Kemp. Richard Kemp is a retired British Army officer, served from 1977 to 2006, completed 14 operational tours around the globe. He spent most of his life fighting terrorism and insurgency. He's commanded British troops on the front lines, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Balkans, and Northern Ireland. He even chaired an intelligence group, maybe not everybody in the world knows about it, but it's kind of famous in England. It's called the Cobra Intelligence Group, which is responsible for coordinating the work of national intelligence agencies, MI5 and MI6. That's cool stuff. His book, Attack Red State, about war-torn Afghanistan, was a Sunday Times bestseller. But for the purposes of this discussion, it's also important to know that Colonel Kemp is an outspoken critic of the international community's stance on Israel and regularly writes and comments on this issue. He's involved with several pro-Israel organizations. I've heard him speak about this many times. And in a sense, for me, Colonel Kemp is exactly a throwback to those incredible men that lived 100 years ago and desperately wanted to see the reconstituting of the Jewish state in the land of Israel for various reasons. We're going to get right to that in a second. Colonel Kemp, welcome to the show.
Yishai, thank you very much. It's really good to be your guest on this. And as always, it's great to be talking to you. Even though I can't see you in person, I can see you on the screen. And it's really good. As you pointed out to me just now, you're always a fun guy. So it's a great
That's right.
pleasure.
That's right. That's right. And I love your room back there. There's a lot of war type of paraphernalia there. You've really been in battle for more than 30 years now with your other battles that you're in. And it reminds me of some of the great generals of the past. For example, General Allenby. And General Allenby is leading the British in World War I, pushing back the Ottoman Turks. And he's coming up the coast from Egypt. He's coming up to Jaffa. He's coming through Gaza. He's fighting there, having a tough fight, coming up to Jaffa. And finally, he's making it up to Jerusalem. And all the while, when he's in process, there's already a kind of effort to turn on the idea that the Jewish people are going to be given the opportunity to reconstitute their presence in this land after the British free this land from the Turks. So I kind of wanted to ask you about your perspective on 1917, you know, 1960, 1917, those ideas at the time, and that British general who's walking up to Jerusalem, and when he finally gets into Jerusalem, dismounts his horse in order to give respect to this holy city.
The year 1917, I think, probably was the most significant year that led to the recreation of the Jewish state eventually in 1948. And there were two things really, and you've certainly touched on one of them, and you've also touched to an extent on another one. Two things occurred in 1917, which led to the, I think more than anything else, to the recreation of the Jewish state. The first of them was the Balfour Declaration, the British government's policy decision to encourage and enable the establishment of Jewish national homeland in the then land of Palestine. And secondly, and I think actually at least as important, possibly more important than the Balfour Declaration, was the campaign you just spoke about, General Allenby's campaign to throw the Ottoman Empire out of Palestine and other parts of the Middle East, and reconquer it for Britain as part of the war effort. Let's not forget that campaign was part of a defensive war after the Turks attacked the British in Egypt. So it was a defensive campaign in which the British were victorious. When I say the British, obviously it wasn't just British, it was also Australians, New Zealanders, people from other countries as well, part of the British Empire fighting. And one element of that battle, which isn't really well known over here, it's probably well known in Israel, but isn't too well known over here, was the role of Jewish people from Palestine that formed an intelligence group called NILI. And NILI was a fundamental element of General Allenby's success. Without the intelligence that was passed by NILI, the Aronson family, who were the sort of backbone of NILI, without the intelligence passed by them, General Allenby's own chief of intelligence has said that he would not have been able to win that conflict in the way he did. Eventually, maybe won, but with many more casualties, and it would have taken longer. So that's the fundamental thing. And the other point I think we should bear in mind when we're talking about this subject is that not in 1917, but the next year in 1918, when Allenby concluded his campaign and threw the Turks completely out of the region, a fundamental part of that was the Jewish Legion, part of the British Army, the first formed Jewish fighting force since the time of the Maccabees. The 38th, 39th, 40th and 41st battalions of the Royal Fusiliers, collectively known as the Jewish Legion, who were formed by Colonel John Patterson in 1917, and actually fought for the first time at Megiddo in 1918. And those brave Jewish soldiers, many of them came from the UK, many came from Palestine itself, some came from the United States of America, Russia and other countries around the world to form this incredible organization that played a key role in defeating the Turks, and of course went on to become, in some respects, the founding fathers of the IDF. Many of the people that fought in the Jewish Legion, and of course fought later, others, younger ones, fought in the Second World War. Many of them from both of the wars were pretty important in founding the IDF. And just very briefly, if I may, John Patterson was a British-Irish colonel, not Jewish, Christian, who after the war, he went to live in the United States of America. And he died in the USA. He was buried in California. And he became a close friend in the US with Prime Minister Netanyahu's father, Benzion Netanyahu, the famous Zionist and historian. And he became so close to him that he asked him to be... I'm not an expert on the Jewish religion, but the equivalent in Judaism of a godfather, as we would have it, to his oldest son, Yoni. And in fact, his oldest son was named Yoni after John Patterson. And of course, Yoni subsequently became the hero of Entebbe. And then when Patterson died, he died in 1947, his wish was to have been buried among the Jewish soldiers he led in battle in Palestine in 1918. But because of the time, it was 47, as I said, it wasn't possible. But a few years back now, his remains were exhumed from California and reinterred in a Jewish military cemetery where his soldiers had been buried in a ceremony presided over by Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I was very fortunate in being able to be there myself.
That's awesome. And that's awesome that you were there. I forgot the part that you were there. I knew the rest. That must have been a special feeling for you because, you know, the UK, the story of the UK's involvement in the rebirth of the Jewish people is very significant. I have a fabulous book right here, which is called The Balfour Declaration by Elliot Yeager. Great book, by the way, and talks about some of the fabulous British people that were involved. And we'll get to a second what their motivation was. But there's also been dark times. You and I, before the show, discussed that we wouldn't get into it too much. But you're the kind of British person who sees the story of Israel as a just story, a rightful story. And it must have been very special for you to be at that re-internment of General Patterson in the land of Israel, a British soldier. By the way, famous for many other things, not just Zionism, including killing these man-eating lions. And yet he's buried here in Israel. It must have been a special moment for you.
It was an incredible moment. I knew a lot about John Patterson, and of course, I knew a lot about many other British military and political leaders who have also been very, very strong supporters of Zionism, and then later of the State of Israel and the Zionism of Israel. And you know, coming to mind immediately is Ord Wingate, another very famous British officer who, in the 1930s, again, not Jewish, Christian, in the 1930s, he, on his own initiative, because of the feeling he had for the Jewish people in the land of Israel, he taught the Jewish farmers and people living in the land at the time, he taught them how to defend themselves against marauding Arab bands who were trying to kill them and drive them out back in the 1930s.
He was the original anti-terror trainer.
Right, absolutely. And he taught them to not just defend yourself in your village, go out and get the enemy, go out at night, get them, kill them when they're not expecting you, and deal with them. And that was, a lot of his philosophy became the kind of policies that are still used today by the IDF. And in fact, David Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel, said that had Ord Wingate, remember, a British Christian officer, had he not been killed in the Second World War, he was killed in Burma in the Second World War as a general in an air crash and later buried in Arlington Military Cemetery in Washington. Ben-Gurion said, had Wingate not been killed in the Second World War, he would have been the first chief of staff of the IDF. So the first chief of staff of the IDF would have been a British Christian officer, which is actually something incredible to think of. But there have been others, you know, obviously people like David Lloyd George, who was the main figure behind the Balfour Declaration, Balfour himself, Winston Churchill. More recently, we had people like Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair, our current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, many, many prominent British figures, but perhaps the best of our leadership, have always been staunch, strong supporters of the Jewish people and of the State of Israel. I just want to mention one other military figure who no one will have heard of, I'm sure, but he's somebody who's quite special to me personally. And he was a guy from my own regiment. I was a member of the Royal Anglian Regiment, which was formed from a number of earlier county regiments, including the Suffolk Regiment. And the Suffolk Regiment during the period of before Israeli independence was based in Palestine, was over there. And they were told, you're moving back, you're going back to Britain. And, you know, there's then going to be a war. The Arabs are going to invade. And they were basically told that the Arabs are going to defeat the Jews in that war. And in fact, Field Marshal Montgomery, the head of the British Armed Forces at the time, he gave, I think, the Jewish people just a matter of weeks to hold out after the Arabs invaded. Anyway, one of these guys in the Suffolk Regiment, my regiment, was called Ringo Watson. Again, he was a Christian, British, I think a corporal or a private at the time. He wasn't a senior officer. Wow. But he realized what was going to happen, and he was not willing to go back to England and just from a distance watch the Jews getting annihilated. He had to fight. So he deserted. When his regiment went, he stayed illegally. He kept his machine gun with him. He went and joined the Haganah, and he fought in the Battle of Jerusalem, was wounded in the Battle of Jerusalem, fought throughout the War of Independence. And after the war, he remained in Israel for a while. And then later he, as these things tend to happen, he met a Jewish girl and married her. And then a bit later on, they decided they would go back to England. He didn't really want to just live as a kind of a, you know, a criminal effectively for the rest of his life, away from his own home. So they went back to England. He actually took his machine gun back with him as well that he'd taken to fight in the War of Independence. In those days, you could take a machine gun on a plane, no doubt dismantled. But, and he handed himself in. He was court-martialed, did a short period in prison because, you know, if you go, if you desert for selfish reasons, that's different. But if you desert to fight, then you're looked at a lot more leniently. And so he did a short time in military prison and then served on in the British Army together with his wife there. And he became a sergeant major and retired just a few years ago, died a few years ago. And he,
wow.
His name was legendary within my regiment, Ringo Watson, John Ringo Watson, his name. No relation to the Beatles, any of the Beatles.
That's an amazing story. That's an amazing story. Now, that leads me exactly to my next question. There were various motivations at the time for British support for a Jewish state in Palestine, in the land of Israel. They were various. For example, T.E. Lawrence was actually in favor of Zionism as well, really because he was in favor of supporting local peoples to rise up against the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, support the British, be allies to the British. And so he saw the Arabs and the Jews not very differently. He saw, he helped turn the Arabs against the Turkish rulers. And so too he said, okay, the Jews are also part of the equation here. They're an indigenous people in this land. They're living here. They could be good for the British Empire. And he supported both of those indigenous peoples as having self-determination and turning against the Turks. That's one very geopolitical reason. Another geopolitical reason was that the UK wanted continued control over the Suez Canal. And the friendly Jewish state, the proto-state, would help them ensure control over the Suez Canal. But then there was one other motivation. There's others, but one clear one, which was a love and a connection with the Bible. And you had that with David Lloyd George. You had that with Balfour. These are people who were steeped in biblical tradition, in reading the Bible. Balfour's mother read him the Bible every night. And they recognized these places, and they felt that this is their great – and here it also bifurcates into two different rationales. One is the great opportunity to reconstitute the Jewish Commonwealth, and another one is to fix some of the wrongs that were perpetrated against Jews by Christendom. And they felt themselves to be emissaries, people who could fix a kind of fix a historical wrong, right a historical wrong by doing this thing. And they were very, very passionate. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about these various motivations of the British Empire at the time, in 1916, 1917, 1920, at San Remo, for the creation of a Jewish state.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question at all that the motives were varied, including self-interest on the part of the UK. And I should, you know, I should just say again that it was really Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, and remember he was fighting a tremendous fight in the First World War. It was certainly not the outcome was certainly not able to be foretold. There was no absolute definite prediction that we would be victorious in the First World War. Many thousands and thousands of British soldiers, American soldiers, later French, were being slayed in the war, as well as Germans, of course. So it was a terrible time. And, you know, I mean, I think the challenges, even today, challenges faced by, for example, our Prime Minister over here, Boris Johnson, and your Prime Minister there, Benjamin Netanyahu, with the coronavirus thing, I think pale into almost insignificance compared to the tremendous challenges he faced. So he was looking for every possible way he could of achieving victory. And you mentioned the desire to maintain control of the Suez Canal, obviously very important. But another very important thing was to keep allies on side and try and harness our allies around the world. And the Jewish people were seen, Jewish people in the United States, I think in particular, but also elsewhere, were seen as being fundamental to that because they played, in many cases, they played significant roles within their own society. And I think that was part of the motivation, not the whole motivation at all, but part of the motivation for the Balfour Declaration and for Britain essentially befriending the Jewish people in this way. And I think, you know, one thing we shouldn't forget, because people will talk about the Balfour Declaration as a, you know, an embodiment of British foreign policy, which it was. But it wasn't British alone. Before Balfour made the declaration, he secured the agreement of all of the major countries in the world that we weren't fighting at the time. So that includes the United States of America. It includes China. It includes, you know, pretty much every other major power, France and so on, that we weren't actually involved in combating. So it wasn't, the Balfour Declaration wasn't just, it was portrayed purely as a British political instrument, but it wasn't just that. It was as, and as it was later enshrined in San Remo, it was, you know, it was an international agreement, and he garnered international support for it. But I do agree with you also that, I'm sure both, you know, Balfour and Lloyd George were both Christians. And Lloyd George in particular, he was a Methodist from Wales, and he saw a lot of commonality in both the religion and in the nature and character of his own country, Wales, with the you know, the future Jewish state. And so I think he had a great deal of sympathy. And you find people like Ord Wingate later on, and John Patterson. These also were religious men, and they were partly motivated by the inspiration of the Bible. And that does go for many, I think, many people, many non-Jewish people who are fervent supporters of Israel. Personally speaking, I'm a Christian as well, but my support for Israel is not, I mean, it's obviously, if anything, reinforced by my knowledge of the Bible, which is not as great as it should be, but certainly not as great as people like Ord Wingate. But, my motivation is not, my personal motivation is not about the Bible. I am a Christian. I am a Zionist, but I don't consider myself a Christian Zionist. In other words, motivated by Christianity. A lot of my motivation is knowing right from wrong. And of course, that comes from my Christian upbringing as well. But I do recognize, the, first of all, the rectitude of the Israeli cause and the wrongness, the absolute black wrongness of those people who want to destroy the state of Israel even today. And there are many of them, not only in the Middle East, but in the West as well. But also, the virtue that Israel has for the whole of the world. And, you know, I've worked closely with the IDF, with other Israeli state organizations, including intelligence services, in my professional career. And I know how much our country, Britain, and also the rest of the Western world, and most of the world itself, and not even outside the West, owes to the state of Israel in terms of, you know, forget about trade and economy, but in terms of just things like technology, military technology, medical technology, intelligence. Israeli intelligence has saved so many lives around the world. And we're fighting the same fight. Israel and the UK and Europe and the US and the Western world is fighting the same fight against the same enemy. And to me, it's important that we stand with our friends and oppose, you know, in union, oppose our enemies.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think also, in general, I've come to this conclusion in life that when something is true, it has many layers. It has many layers of truth. And it could be true on a biblical plane, on a reconstitution plane. It could have been good for British foreign policy with their strategic global situation. And what you're saying is another side of it, which is the justice of the Israeli cause, and also how should we say it in one word, the usefulness, the good, the light that comes out of Israel for the world. It's important to for people that aren't so familiar with it to understand that the Balfour Declaration was fully included into the San Remo Accords, and Arthur James Balfour was actually there in San Remo and making sure that was going to happen. It was incorporated, the idea that there was going to be a Jewish state, and that happened 100 years ago, really today, 25th of April, 1920, in San Remo, Italy. And later, 2 years later, a document was formulated, the mandatory document, which is a fabulous document, which recognizes Jewish rights in the land of Israel. It doesn't grant, but recognize. It talks about reconstituting. It talks about a right of return. And it also talks about a system by which minorities living in the land will be respected, will have civil rights, will have religious rights, but not necessarily political rights, because the folks back then saw that there was going to be Arab states formed through the mandate, But this one was meant to be a small Jewish state. So it was going to be strong Arab states and one small, strong Jewish state. And that's how we were going to have regional harmony, shall we say. Maybe not peace, but harmony. Sadly, that attitude did not prevail. But that was the original vision.
Can I also, Yishai, can I make one further point, which sort of complements what you said, which is that not only was the Balfour Declaration essentially made part of a legal treaty at San Remo, and then in the British mandate, or the League of Nations mandate for Palestine handed to Britain, but also the rights of the Jewish people, as well as other the Arab peoples in their countries, were enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations when the United Nations was first founded. So the legal rights of the Jewish people to their own homeland in the land of Palestine, now called Israel, then called Israel as well, but you know, that more widely known as Palestine by that, it's not just some anachronism from history. It was enshrined in the UN Charter. And of course, you know, it since then, it obviously after, you know, after the mandate was given to the UK, we said we weren't going particularly to speak about this, but I'll just mention it. After the mandate was given to the UK, the UK reneged on that mandate. And why did the UK renege on it? Because the UK came under enormous pressure from the Arab population in the Middle East to restrict Jewish immigration or even prevent any Jewish immigration into the land. And Britain succumbed to that pressure, I'm afraid to say. Churchill hated it. Churchill stood up against the government as it sort of caved into this Arab pressure. But it maintained, and it persisted right the way through. That same pressure and Britain's same policies persisted right the way through until the War of Independence in 1948, and even beyond then. But I'm very pleased to say that today, I think Britain has in many ways, certainly officially in terms of the government, has restored its previous stance towards Israel. We are, you know, I'd say Britain and Israel, apart from maybe Britain and the US, we are two of the closest allies. And it's based partly on trade and economy, partly on military and intelligence cooperation. I don't think there's any closer intelligence allies in the world than Britain and Israel, the United States, etc. It's often below the radar horizon because of the political sensitivities, shameful though that is to say, of openly and positively supporting and backing Israel. I do believe that that's going to get even better. It's good at the moment. I think it's going to get even better as Britain completely leaves the EU when we're able to shrug off the EU's overwhelming anti-Israel stance, and hopefully revert to being, you know, again, the people that directly led, I think, to the recreation of the State of Israel, as I mentioned, through both the Balfour Declaration in 1917 and the destruction of the Ottoman Empire in 1917-1918. And I think, you know, I started off by saying I think that the military campaign by Lord Allenby in 1917-18 was at least as significant as Balfour Declaration. The reason I say that is because if he hadn't defeated the Turks in the land of Palestine, then why would they not still be running it today? Why would they still not be there today? And if they were still running it, would there have been a Jewish state recreated? The answer, of course, is a very resounding no.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I want to, you know, I honor you as a kind of emissary of that way of thinking and acting, all the way from General Allenby to yourself, to Boris Johnson. And yes, we there were also dark periods, but today we celebrate the great periods. And today we're celebrating 72 years of Israeli independence, Jewish independence in the land of Israel, and also 100 years since the San Remo Accords, which brought the Balfour Declaration out of just British policy. And it was even less than policy. It was like a kind of position paper into international law, and really began the process of reconstituting the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Colonel Richard Kemp, you're a great fighter around the world for British interests, but you've also been a great fighter for justice, and within that, the cause of Israel. I want to thank you and wish you a happy Yom HaAtzmaut.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure. Great pleasure speaking to you. And I hope to see you soon in the promised land.
That's right. As we say, next year in person, right?
I hope this year.
Very good. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Yishai.
This week, Jeremy Gimpel with a special important message on the final return of Israel.
Every individual has divine providence in their life because Abraham was just one man. He was one family, and the Jewish people are an extension of just this one promise given to one man. And as his destiny unfolds through us, the world sees that everyone has a destiny.
For the full show, click on Jeremy Gimpel on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Judea. Obviously, from if you're watching on Zoom, it's from my little man cave here in Judea, and this is, you know, a small tiny place of respite of trying to find some peace, because there are two kinds of people in this world: ones with small children in the house and ones that don't have it. And I am of the kind that have children in the house, and so is Rabbi Mike Foyer, who joins us. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Shalom and welcome from the hiding of my bedroom, actually.
Right.
Okay. I don't even have a separate man cave. I'm just in the only space that I can call my own.
Right. But this is, and you got like a literally a white wall, not a white wall, like a white wall behind you. And you're like in your, like, you know, this is
better than the dirty laundry on the other side.
There's a song, you know, HaCheder HaIntimi Sheli. You remember that's an Israeli song? Yeah. Maybe I sang it before on the show. And that's where we're at these days. You know, Rabbi Mike, we're talking today on, first thing, we're on the Land of Israel Network, Yishai Fleisher Show, yourself. Yeah. If I haven't mentioned it, you're an educator, a counselor, and also the founder of the...
And a damn good man.
That's right. The Jewish Story podcast here on the Land of Israel Network. I haven't mentioned that in some time. Today is Yom HaShoah, Israel Holocaust Remembrance Day. We'll get to that in a second. And we're on the way now towards Yom HaZikaron, Israel Memorial Day, and then on to Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day. So we're right in the swing of a very powerful kind of holiday season, the modern holidays, the Zionist holidays.
Chutzah Levona.
Right, that's right. That's right. But if you notice, I'm wearing blue and you're wearing white. And together
we're patriots.
Together we form Voltron. But before we get to that, I actually want to make one comment about Corona life. That's what I call it. I call it Corona life. Right? L'chaim. So one comment on Corona life, which is, you remember that verse in the story of Noah, the story of Noah's Ark, that when it's time to take out the animals, when it's landing time and it's over and it's cool, it's time to get back to normal living, like the animals are a little bit stuck inside the ark. They're not ready to kind of be reanimated. There's something about it all, which is like you when you go into hibernation, think about it, just like waking up in the morning, you go into hibernation, it's not so easy to get out of hibernation. And you go into a deep sleep or deep freeze, it's not so easy to come out of the deep freeze. And by the way, I'm absolutely certain that the resurrection of the dead is going to be like that as well. It's not easy to resurrect the dead. It's, as we know from chapter 37 of the book of Ezekiel, it's a thing. And so I'm a little bit concerned about is like actually coming back out. You become life shy. I actually haven't left the house so much in like a month. I have here and there, but like, I'm just saying, coming back out into a hyper fast world is, you know, a world that you have to balance all the time. I mean, I hope, and Bezrat Hashem, we should come out of this and defeat this disease. But do you hear what I'm saying with that concern and fear?
Absolutely. I mean, they, you know, we've been institutionalized on some level, right? You've seen Shawshank Redemption, I'm guessing, right? I mean, that is on some level what we've all been experiencing, obviously in a very small, and I don't mean to compare us to being, you know, life in prison, but you know, in terms of coming out into that fast-paced, crazy world, being life shy, my hope is that we'll come out with more wisdom about what's actually important. And it's one of the things that's been so dominant in my mind. You keep hearing this phrase, essential services. You're allowed out of the house for essential activities. People who are participating in essential services are allowed to go to work. And it just raises the question, like, what's all the other stuff? Like, if right. it's non-essential, then maybe we could be doing a lot of other things with those resources, with those human hours, with what have you. I mean, listen, people need to work and they need to eat, and it's a desperate situation out there for a number of people. But it does beg the question of are we able to maintain the distinction that we've been gifted with between what's essential and what's not, in a way that will allow for a rebuilding of life on more essential foundations?
Another question that I have about this time is about our brothers and sisters in the United States and the incredible ferocity with which this plague has plagued them. And I wonder that here in Israel, we just had a 48-year-old man with, get this, 14 children pass away.
14 kids.
Yeah. 48 years old, 14 kids. And we lost them yesterday. And, you know, for everyone who suffers like that, that is an indescribable disaster. But still, on the grand scale, like, you see American Jewry, especially New York American Jewry, really being hit so hard. And I just wanted to, and here in Israel, where we feel somehow protected, if it's maybe by the good work of Prime Minister Netanyahu and his team, or maybe very kind of what's the word when you can really feel the sensory feeling, very very viscerally, by the hand of God. I think a lot of people feel that there's like a hand of God that's protecting us here.
And I would say, by the way, that I don't really distinguish between the two. Not that I'm saying that Netanyahu is the hand of God, but in the sense that, like, what it means to live in the land of Israel is to live an embodied divine existence. The fact that we have a government where, you know, where Pesach was a primary concern, that our government put literally something like 2 billion shekels into the bank accounts of every family in the country, knowing that Pesach was going to be difficult, that they tried to airlift eggs. Granted, you know, the Exodus, as you called it, right, was not entirely successful. But that was what we say nechshav, that
we were in exile, what? And so before we were in that's my we my in daughter exile. We were in exile, and so we needed an Exodus to bring, you know, to bring the eggs back to the land of Israel.
And then I told you, I made it through. I made it through Chag with 8 eggs.
Yafe.
In the merit of our good friend Zev Ornstein.
Yafe.
He could have long and healthy life.
Amen. I was. This is just a joke here, but I was in the supermarket with my face mask on, and there was no eggs, and there was like a lot of people around me at safe distances, and I'm like, this is because of Zera Levatala, and everybody's like.
No, you actually said that.
I said it out loud, like I'm like, it's because of Zera Levatala, and everybody was like, everybody like looked inward, was like, ooh. You know, okay, ooh. I'm not going to translate that, and Hamevin Yavin, you know, that's it.
Hamevin Yavin, all
that's
right,
it. Hamevin Yavin, that's it. By the way, I'll translate what Hamevin Yavin means. So, it means he who understands understands. And you could look it up if you want.
Yeah, we're not going to get to no.
That's it. Speaking.
No, where are you going?
Speaking of plagues, we have a Torah portion that talks about skin lesions and lesions on the house and different kinds of lesions. It's one of the more cryptic Torah portions.
It's a twofer.
It's a twofer this year because we do not have a leap year, so we're reading Tazria Metzora. It starts actually with birth, with Jewish birth, and with the offerings that a woman has to bring after bearing a child, and different offerings depending if it's a girl or a boy. So that's how the Torah portion starts out with, which is in a sense, you know, quite hopeful. And you know, yes, childbirth comes with pain, with bleeding, and with a certain bit of tum'ah, which is ritual. What do you call that? Ritual
impurity.
But then the Torah portion goes into these lesions. So you start off with something that's kind of, you know, okay, this is life, and it's got an element of death in it. But why does it make that transition from childbirth to this whole world of like skin lesions that come through sin?
I think that the fundamental principle of tuman tarav, purity and impurity, and I'm always wary of translating those terms because the baggage, the cultural context of the words purity and impurity in English is a very different context than that in Hebrew. But I think the most basic principle is that anything that has potential for purity also has the potential for impurity, right? And I think it's something that you've said a number of times on the show, which is that, you know, every opportunity for the sanctification of God's name is also a tremendous risk for the desecration of God's name. So here a human being is born into the world pure, but it's bound up with this potential for impurity, right? And therefore we then get the story of how such a thing can progress, not only in the human, but in the human's possessions, in the dwelling, you know, and it just teach us that most of the Torah is devoted to how one serves God, how one makes oneself not only pure, but holy. And that's, of course, the central world will be there quite soon. And we've been there for the rest of this book. You know, Vayikra is devoted to the concept of holiness. But just to remember that the same people who have a potential for holiness have a potential for the stain of impurity.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I noticed
sort of one of the fundamental.
I noticed you made a distinction between purity and holiness, and that, of course, is the Ramchal's famous kind of idea that purity is the thing that gives your vessel the opportunity to get the kind of the holiness power. Let's think of it this way. It's like a mug. Purity is when you clean it and you really prepare it. Holiness is when somebody comes and pours an amazing cup of coffee. It. Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that purity is the gateway to holiness.
Right.
It's that.
It's a gateway drug. Is that what you're saying?
It prepares us, but it removes. Yeah. Well, no. Come on. It removes the barriers, right? Because holiness is always an act of intimacy, right? And that's why the last sort of bastion of purity as a practice within Jewish life today, as long as the temple hasn't been rebuilt, we should merit to see it. But until then, the last bastion is in the intimate relationships within marriage.
I love this phrase
called Tarat Mishpacha.
This is an amazing phrase that you've come up with, in my opinion, which is that holiness is an act of intimacy. I love it. I love that. I love that phrase. I love that phrase. I think that's fabulous.
Well, think about what's in the Kodesh HaKodeshim.
Right. Mm-hmm. Love. That's at the heart of it. Intimacy and love.
You can only ever be there alone.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and you can only ever be there alone.
So I just want to tell you a little story. My kids got for one of their Afikoman presents or whatever, they got this triad of DVDs about I forgot what it's called, Night at the Museum. It's with Ben Affleck, what's his name? Oh gosh. Ben, I forgot his name.
Night of the Living Dead? You got your kids Night of the Living Dead?
What? No, not Night of the Living Dead.
Sorry, I misheard you.
I know, it's this Night at the Museum. Ben Stiller, that's what it is. Basically it's got like an Egyptian tablet. A magical tablet, and that tablet brings the whole museum to life at night times. So it's got a shtickle of, it's got a little bit of you know, these silly ideas of like Egyptology and stuff, but really it's a nice movie and it's very fun and all those things come to life if it's, you know, the animals and all kinds of miniature people and all kinds of stuff that's found at the Museum of Natural History comes to life. It's really fun. But my son says to me, was this tablet a real thing? Says my son to me. So I said to him, absolutely not. But there is a tablet like that. I said to him, there is something like that that gives life to things. So he said to me, what? I said to him, a mezuzah. I said to him, the mezuzah is affixed to our doors, and it brings the energy of God into our life, and it turns us from just kind of talking animals to really people who follow the ways of God and bring God into their house. And I said to him, so there is a tablet like that that enlivens us and makes us from mere bones and flesh into really spiritual creatures, the mezuzah. And then I told him also the difference that I think between a mezuzah and a tefillin. I said to him, the tefillin is the man's scroll. Man, ostensibly, man is on the move. He's out. He's out there working. While the woman, I don't mean this to limit anybody, but archetypally I'm speaking, the archetype, woman energy is like she's the controller of the house. The house is her. The house is a kind of womb where everything kind of grows. And so she's got the scroll and the men have the scroll. And these scrolls are affixed to our homes and our bodies. And they enliven us. And he really liked that. He really liked that. He really felt that like he gave him and I tried to give him the image like, look at this. This is a glow. Like imagine it lighting up and lighting up this room and lighting up our life. So that's a little bit of that act of intimacy that you spoke about. Speaking of homes, there's also Metzora on the homes. There's also this lesion on the houses. Now, every good pro-Israel Zionist person loves this part of the story, right? Because Rashi tells us that when you would get a house lesion, you would kind of have to take parts of that house, those bricks that have been infected out. You do shiputzim. Which means like a Israeli a home repair.
Fix it.
Right? Fixer-upper. And then you would find some of the treasures that were left behind by the Canaanites in the houses that you inherited, which I think I take it to mean, in simple terms, that that bad stuff that happens to us in life, if you dig a little deeper, you're going to find the treasure behind it. You're going to find the treasure, like...
And I would point out that you know, the Zionist side to that is that only occurred, of course, in the land of Israel.
Right.
And so to extend your metaphor is that the ability to dig into the difficulties of life and find the blessing which is within them, which I agree with you, it's always there. That ability, though, depends on having a strong enough vessel to hold it.
Right.
Right. And that goes back to this comment you made earlier, is that here in the state of Israel, which is on part of the land of Israel, we have a strong vessel that allows us to hold. This corona situation is very difficult, and you know, the death of this young father is a tragedy, but we have the vessel here to hold this situation in a much stronger way than our brothers and sisters in America, because they're not sovereign. Mm-hmm. They're a minority within a country which is struggling with a very real challenge.
I read an article, actually Malka read it to me, and basically the guy was visiting America, and he said, listen, when you're sick and you can't go to shul in America, you are a total autonomous, you are no longer bound into the general thing, because you don't have the thing that envelops you and brings you together, which is the synagogue, that central mechanism to bring Jews together. And so you're left totally detached. Obviously, Hello? There's great efforts at Chesed and, you know, great efforts at Chesed. By the way, like, for example, somebody told me, I heard this also, that the Satmar Rebbe turned the whole Beit Midrash into a hospital. Just closed down the Beit Midrash, turned it into a ventilator hospital for his people. Wow. So there is great Chesed, but still, though, there's definitely a challenge out there when you're facing the situation more alone than we feel here in Israel. Speaking of feeling alone and challenged, today is Yom HaShoah, one of the most powerful days on the Israeli Jewish calendar, and it remembers the 6 million. And it more than remembers the you know, when you say the word 6 million, it starts to sound a little, I don't know, you know,
when it gets down to stories and the Israelis, yeah, exactly. You made the fly over the head sign. When you get down to nitty gritty stories, you are so touched and moved. And the miracles. So last night I was watching Israeli TV and they had these great, great films about what happened to the Shoah. And one of them was about this little Hungarian lady. When I say little, she was little. She's one of the youngest survivors because she was born in Auschwitz. Wow. In 1944. She was born in Auschwitz. Her mother hit her. Yeah, she was literally born a few weeks before liberation. And her mother hit her and people helped. And she hit her in newspapers. Now, this little girl couldn't walk for years because she was so malnourished. And I think she only took her first steps at the age of 7, something ridiculous. And people said that she wasn't going to make it. And she ended up having 2 kids. And she goes to Auschwitz like every year or every other year. What, and had a beautiful granddaughter with her. What a story of unbelievable self-sacrifice to survive. And that like, that was my Yom HaShoah. That did it for me. You know what I mean? Mm. That really, really did it for me. I want to tell you one more thing about Yom HaShoah. On Zoom, you can see it. Do you see this picture behind me? Oops, I moved the wrong way. Do you see this picture out by Mike behind one? Me? The one.
Akedat Yitzchak?
Yeah, Akedat Yitzchak.
Isaac, yeah.
Yeah, it's a needlepoint of Akedat Yitzchak. Not everybody likes it because it's a little raw.
I personally love it, but I don't like needlepoint.
Well, guess what? Malka and I were reading Isaac Batsheva Singer, and he was telling the story of this kind of needlepoint of Akedat Yitzchak. He mentioned that. Oh, yeah. He mentioned this thing. So, the reason I say this, the reason I point to this is because you're going to love this story. Rabbi Mike, you're going to love this one. I had Christiane Amanpour at my house when I was living in Jerusalem, right? Remember that famous TV show? So she goes to me, so why do you have this picture of the sacrifice of Isaac? Is it like she like insinuated that like I'm some kind of Bible nut or something like that, right?
I was ready to kill his children for the sake of God.
Right, willing to do anything to hold on to the land, including killing Arabs, whatever, right?
And your own children, right?
Right, my own children. Right, exactly. You're willing to put your children in this dangerous situation because you guys are crazy like Abraham. Yeah. So I said to her, well, you know, the real meaning of this needlepoint is that my wife's grandmother, who was an Auschwitz survivor, made it after she came out of the camps. And we honor her survival and the incredible challenge that the Jewish people have gone through to survive till today. That's it. I didn't say another thing.
She's like, cut.
Yeah, exactly. It was like
moving on.
So just for a second, this triad: Yom HaShoah, Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut. Tell me a little bit about that that thing, and coupled with that is, I guess, the Shabbat of Pesach, where we read about the dry bones. The dry bones, which is really a vision of the resurrection of the Jewish people in the land of Israel after some kind of huge disaster where there's all these dead Jews and they're reborn, re-embodied, as you say.
You know, I mean, if I was going to go with that metaphor from Yechezkel, right, that the Shoah is really the low point of Jewish history. I mean, it's true, it didn't strike every Jew, but if you look at us as a collective body, this is the point in which that we had no ability to act for ourselves. And yet, within a matter of a decade, we had a military that was able to compete with not just the surrounding Arab armies, but even, you know, sought as an ally by the European powers. And so there's a sense in Yom HaZikaron that the Mesirut Nefesh, right, that self-sacrifice that you're speaking about, in this story of this woman born in Auschwitz, but it's not just a self-sacrifice. One of the things that people misunderstand about the binding of Isaac is that it's a commitment to life. It's a story about a commitment to life, but it's not life of a small L. Not my life. It's not the humanism of the human life is the ultimate value. It's life with a capital L, right? Which comes from God, right? That's the life that flows into the world, into the wholeness of the Jewish people, which is why a soldier that dies in battle in many ways is more alive than anyone else could ever be, because they are taking their small L life and releasing it for the sake of the larger life. And that, you know, is that turning point between Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron. And ultimately, Yom HaAtzma'ut tells us, why did this soldier do that? Because Atzma'ut, as we spoke about not long ago before the show, right? Atzma'ut doesn't really mean independence. It means self-actualization, right? You know, that famous poem, Al Magash Kesef, right? That we were handed the state on a silver platter, referring to the lives of those who sacrificed in order to give us a platform which creates an obligation. And I say that without hesitation. We have an obligation to every young man and woman who has sacrificed their life, and even those who have lived but have sacrificed the years of their life. They should be healthy and well and live to 120, but still, people like yourself, right? They sacrifice years of their life in order to create a society, and that obligation is to use it to actualize not only ourselves, not only the capacity of the Jewish people, but in service of the divine vision for the world. That's kind of how I see that triad, as you called it.
And all that is on route towards, it's between the Exodus, which is the kind of 2 days of Passover. The first day is leaving Egypt. The last day is the splitting of the Red Sea towards, and then it's got all these holidays in the middle, all these important dates along the way, all the way towards that pinnacle, which is Shavuot, accepting the Torah. At Sinai, and the Kabbalah basically explains that the difference between Shavuot and Pesach is that Pesach, you kind of get it from God. It came top down. He just hands it over to you. You're a baby, and he feeds you. Then you go through a process of earning it, getting it, self-sacrifice, growth, effort, and you hit it at the point where you're like, at Sinai, you're like, I'm not a baby anymore. I want to be your servant. I'm here to serve God. I'm here as a grown up. I'm doing this by choice, as you said. And that's the path that we're on. And we're also on that path nationally right now. We were given, we had a Holocaust. We had all these wars foisted upon us. Now we're in the process of maybe we're post-war, maybe God, you know, maybe. God willing. And now we're in the process of trying to figure out who we are. And you always talk about this, like the vision of where we're going with all this. And I got a feeling that at the 72-year mark of Independence Day and the 100-year mark of the declaration at San Remo, recognizing a vision of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel 100 years ago by the Allied powers that destroyed that won the war and destroyed the Ottoman Empire and carved it up. I think that we're at a moment where we want to ask ourselves a bigger question of like, I think we're ready now to be like, where are we really going? Where are we going? I think the nation wants to ask that question now.
Listen, I'll give you the since you brought up the Kabbalah, right? I'm sure you're familiar with the idea that there are various names of God that are embedded in our tradition. And one of them, perhaps the most powerful and sacred, is the 72-letter name of God.
Right.
If you're familiar with the origin of the 72-letter name of God, which we're not going to discuss right now, but it's bound up with the verses around the splitting of the Red Sea.
Right.
Which means that the splitting of the Red Sea was a revolution in creation, which brought a new name of God into the world. Right? The world will never be the same after such a thing. Right? And in the same way, the 72 years of Israel, I really feel like is an invitation to say, well, what's the new name of God that's come into the world with the birth of the state?
Mm-hmm.
And not just as a new like term for reference to the deity. That's not what it means. It's a name which allows for a different consciousness, a different way of being in the world. This is one of the challenges that we face as a people, is that we haven't really internalized how fundamentally different the world we live in is than the one whose wisdom that we've inherited. And I'm not one of these people that says you should chuck out the baby with the bathwater and we should just start again. But I am a believer that we need to actually ask the deep questions about how do we embrace our tradition while at the same time moving forward into a future which is in many ways new. And I think that that's part of the struggle and the conversation that we need to be having right now. It goes back to this Corona situation.
Right.
So much that wasn't working for the world could fall by the wayside right now. Or we could get let out, like, you know, kids, you know, have been seeing these jokes that all these people in their sort of like 50s and 60s have been writing on social media. Wow, I feel like I'm a kid again. Gas is cheap and I'm grounded, right? We could very easily just go right back when we get out of our rooms. My hope is that we won't. My hope is that we'll really take this opportunity and think about how the world will never be the same again.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it is a massive opportunity. I think a lot of people have done introspection. I do foresee people coming out and saying to themselves, okay, I got my 50, 40, 30, 20 years to live. I'm going to live it. I'm going to live it. And in every way, I'm going to learn that Torah. I'm going to make that Aliyah. I'm going to buy that apartment in Jerusalem. I'm just going to go crazy. I'm going to ask that girl to marry me. You know what I mean? I'm not going to be afraid. And I think people are going to, I think there's going to be.
I'll tighten that. I said, I won't let my fear stop me from living my life.
Good.
Because
good, I like that.
Because, you know, sometimes fear is just reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it's not easy to
have to prevent you. That's what courage is. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Courage. It's the flexing of the muscle of courage, right? It's a muscle you have to actually flex. Okay. So Rabbi Mike, I want to wish you a powerful Yom HaShoah memorial. May we merit to live a life that gives life to the 6 million. And thank you for also mentioning the life, the enlivenment of the, I don't know how to say it, the those who sacrificed their lives for the state of Israel, for our defense. We thank them and we honor them. Again, we're going to live a life as meaningful as possible. And like, you know, when you strike me down, I just get more powerful. And I think of that, by the way. I think of that line when I think about Ari Fuld. I think to myself, Ari went down. Ari was a friend. He was a colleague. He was a neighbor. You strike down Ari, he's not replaceable. You can't replace him, but you could take his place. Right. You can't replace him, but you could take his place in the line. And you get more power. Maybe that's also what we learned from Elijah and Elisha. It's like, before you go, make sure I got twice as much power from you. You know what I mean? Let me reflect it even bigger. And that's what I think about Ari Fuld. And finally, a happy Yom Ha'atzma'ut. Enjoy your vegetarian barbecue. I know that you are considered one of the greatest vegetarian barbecuers alive today.
Of the generation.
Yeah, you're one of the leaders of the generation when it comes to vegetarian barbecue.
It's actually hard to barbecue a vegetarian because they fight when you put them on the grill.
That's true.
Sorry.
Are we going back to the binding? I'm just talking
about vegetarian barbecuer.
I'm just talking about putting up an eggplant, you know? What's your like number one? What's your best surprising barbecue vegetable?
In all honesty, when I barbecue, I do it for my kids. I make them meat. I don't even bother.
Oh, but you don't eat the meat?
They sound a little disappointed. I don't eat them.
But what is your best vegetable that you barbecue?
I do like roasting peppers on the grill. I think that's probably it's simple.
Yeah, I thought you were gonna say squash or something. You know, all right.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I just feel like, you know, the grill is not a place for a vegetarian to really seek their sustenance. That's just how I feel.
Okay, well, I want to bless you. I want to bless you with sustenance, and I know that you're going to be eating meat when the Beit HaMikdash comes. So I hope that you eat meat soon. Wink, wink.
Amen.
God bless you, folks, wherever you are. Rabbi Mike Foyer, say thank you so much for being with us today. And strong memories, strong blessings, and thank you for that thought about 72 years and 72 letters of God. And a new way of bringing kind of God into this world, a new world that can be reborn after this thing.
All right, folks, thank you so much for joining me here on the Land of Israel Network. Lots of blessings to you wherever you are. Lots of love, lots of healing, lots of prayer and meditation. And let's though we are physically apart, let us get even closer together, all of us, one to one another, one to our family members, to our dogs, to the air, to the sky above, to the God that is everywhere, to the Torah. This is a chance to really embrace things that the pace of life has not allowed us to. And of course, with that, I also send all of you a blessing, whoever needs it, for speedy recovery, for friends and family, and for blessings of total health and strength once again for the whole world. God bless you folks wherever you are. Shalom, and thank you for being with us. Lots of love from the land of Israel, from the land of love, from the land of blessings. Shalom.